We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings, as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is January 10, 2015, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, here every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, as well as at our new website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Tonight, we will be joined by Joe Gisondi. He is the author of Monster Trek. He will be our guest today, a story of his journeys meeting those who search for Bigfoot. He was intrigued by guys like Matt Moneymaker and Jeff Meldrum, and he wrote a book about it. We're going to talk about it here tonight on the show. Joe Gisondi coming up here in a few moments. We'll talk about that. It's going to be a fun time. Want to recommend everybody check out the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I've been mentioning it here for a while, and man, just been a couple of weeks and we've added a lot of great stuff. First off, if you have not heard, Carl Stern is doing a weekly show at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We now have had two episodes. The latest episode of Dragon King Dark, as it is being called, is up right now. The episode is about fear. It's on the very top of the AfterDarkRadioShow.com website if you're listening to this show live, so head up there and grab it. It will be replaced. It will be bumped to the bottom of the page as soon as this show goes off the air. This show will be replacing it. But every week you can grab both new shows up on the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Of course, this show goes up Sunday night, Monday morning, and Carl's show goes up midweek. Sometimes it'll be up on Wednesdays. Sometimes it'll be up on Thursdays. Still working on the posting abilities here for Carl, but so far so good. We got it up on Friday this week. It'll be up even earlier from now on. And once again, you can check it out at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. A great episode about one of Carl's favorite topics, that being fear. Also, we've got a columnist, as talked about last week. His name is Mark Howes, and he's doing a weekly column up on the website. Last week, he talked about the time slip phenomenon. And this week, he's got a story about bi-location, existing in two places at the same time. And I'm going to read a little bit from his newest column here in just a moment. If you want to read the whole thing, it is up at the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. I was doing an in-the-news section, but in-the-news was basically just finding interesting stories online and providing a link to them. Why do that when you could set up an RSS feed? Particularly if it is the RSS feed for one of my favorite websites, which is The Anomalist. We've had Chris Savia of The Anomalist on the show a couple times in the past, and hopefully we can get him on again. But the link is up there right now. It's basically an RSS feed on the left-hand side of the page. The latest big stories from The Anomalist website. So head up there and check those out. Lots of great stuff up there today, including a story about the declassified documents, the U.S. military's secret Cold War Space Project Revealed. This from Scientific American, and a lot of other great stuff as well. Plus an article about the death of Riley Martin. Those of you that have satellite radio, maybe you're a Howard Stern fan, you are well aware of Riley Martin. He loved talking about extraterrestrials and more. And unfortunately, he has passed away. But there's a story about him up right now at The Anomalist. It is a link to the Howard Stern Show, so you can head over there and look at that. Also want to mention at the very bottom of the page, I've added the contact information for this show. If you want to contact me, my email address, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. Carl Stern can be contacted at carl@dragonkingcarl.com. And guest booking, if you'd like to be a guest on the program, the man to contact is Kenneth Nita. That's kennethnita@gmail.com. That is up there right now. You can also go to the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. Andrew Ludsky is the curator, I guess you would call it, of the Facebook page. He is the Facebook webmaster. He does a great job. And you can message him on the Facebook page if you have a guest request or you think you would be a great guest on the program. Facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. Message Andrew through the Facebook page and he can try and get you set up to be a guest on this show. Also, my Twitter @BrianAlvarez if you want to follow me there. Closing in on 30,000 followers, maybe you could be lucky 30,000. So head up there to my Twitter, @BrianAlvarez. I post all sorts of stuff, mostly professional wrestling, since that is my main job, but a lot of other After Dark sort of things as well. Maybe I'll do more After Dark related articles up there on the Twitter page, but you can always check that out, @BrianAlvarez on Twitter. Make sure you follow me there. The new columnist Mark Howes has got a column here today about bilocation, which is the essentially existing in two places at the same time. I'm going to read part of this, and if you want to read the whole thing, head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Imagine, if you will, that you are happily snoozing away one night when all of a sudden you become aware that there is someone else in the room with you. Not only that, you recognize the person as your own father. Startled, you ask your father what he's doing, only for him to vanish before your eyes. The next morning, you ring your old man and tell him what's happened, and he tells you that he hasn't left the house for a day. This would be an example of a bilocation, which is an alleged psychic or miraculous ability wherein an individual or object is located, or appears to be located, in two distinct places at the same time. Accounts are most commonly found in Catholic lore, but the phenomenon can be found in Greek mythology, Roman mythology, shamanism, Hinduism, occultism, and Jewish mysticism, and across many hundreds, if not thousands, of years. In many cases, the person being viewed is aware of the bilocation, and in some they are not. There are even accounts of people deliberately projecting themselves and accounts of foreshadowing of future events. So let's just get straight into some stories. The most famous example of bilocation is from November of 1917. General Luigi Cadorna, chief of the Italian General Staff, sits in his tent after his armies had taken a good kicking by the Germans in Slovenia and contemplates committing suicide. A monk appears, as if from thin air, and admonishes the general. "Don't be stupid," he says, before vanishing. Many years later, when visiting Rome, Cadorna came across Pedro Pio and immediately recognized him as the monk from his tent. Before the general could say anything, Padre Pio said, quote, "You had a lucky escape, my friend." Padre Pio was known to have been in his monastery in Foggia at the time of the apparition and nowhere near the general. Bilocation. You can read Mark Howe's entire column up on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now. And if you haven't head up, you can also check out his column from last week examining the time slip phenomenon, where you slip into the past or into the future. That is up there right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. As far as the news this week, did you buy a Powerball ticket? I am not a gambler. My grandmother is a gambler, loves going to the casino. I am not a gambler myself, but when the Powerball hit $949.8 million, I did in fact go buy some Powerball tickets. Didn't expect to win, but I sat there and I thought, man, the things I could do with the radio show if we had $949 million. We would be the biggest radio show in the world. I would go and buy up every affiliate if need be. Thought of a lot of cool ideas, bought a couple of tickets, and the bad news is I did not win. Now, I guess it's bad news. I guess the good news, if you want to call it that, is nobody won. With no winners in Saturday night's record $949.8 million Powerball drawing, the next jackpot could reach an estimated $1.3 billion, lottery officials said early Sunday. The winning numbers were 16, 19, 32, 34, 57, and a Powerball of 13. To win the jackpot, all six numbers must be correct. The first five can be in any order, but the sixth must be the Powerball number. Nobody got it. Says here that Gary Grief, the executive director of the Texas Lottery, told ABC News on Sunday he was surprised to see the results of Saturday night's drawing. He said 25 players won a $1 million prize, and three others won a $2 million prize. If you don't play, Grief advised, you will not win. The estimated cash value of the next drawing is $806 million. There is a 1 in $292.2 million chance of, there's a 1 in $292.2 million chance of winning the Powerball's grand prize. Think of that. $1 billion. And you have a 1 in $292.2 million chance of winning. I know it doesn't work this way, but if anybody has $292.2 million, let me know, because I got a lot of tickets that I'm going to buy, hoping I make that jackpot. And on the subject of lotteries, this from unexplained-mysteries.com. A husband and wife from the UK missed out on the lottery jackpot despite matching all six numbers. Winning the lottery should have been a dream come true, but for grandparents Edwina and David Nylan, who managed to pick all six numbers in the UK lottery draw just before Christmas, jubilance and celebration very quickly turned into misery when they realized to their horror that their entry into the draw hadn't registered properly due to a technical issue during purchase. We've tried to laugh about it, but we're completely distraught, said Edwina. We've spent years paying out for the lottery, and this money could have changed our lives. To make matters worse, the payment for the ticket did eventually go through, but by then it was too late. The draw had already passed, and the matching numbers were no longer valid. It was like all of our dreams had come crashing down around us, said Edwina. We feel like we've been cheated out of it. Can you imagine? Can you imagine next week, what is it here? $1.3 billion. And you go to buy, and they claim, they give you the ticket and everything, and they claim, here's your numbers, you're good to go. And it turns out the payment didn't go through. You win, and by the time the payment goes through, it's too late, and you're out $1.3 billion. Holy smokes. Could we soon speak telepathically? It's from the Mail Online. A mind-reading computer deciphers words for brainwaves before they are spoken. A mind-reading device that can decipher words from brainwaves without them being spoken has been developed by Japanese scientists, raising the prospect of telepathic communication. Researchers have found the electrical activity in the brain is the same when words are spoken and when they are left unsaid. By looking for the distinct waveforms produced before speaking, the team was able to identify words such as goo, scissors, and par when spoken in Japanese. Researchers from Japan use technology that measures the electrical activity of the brain to decipher brain waves that occur before somebody speaks. They found distinct brain waves were formed before syllables were spoken. Scientists behind the technology said they can identify brain waves associated with syllables or letters of the Japanese alphabet, meaning it may be possible to decode entire words and sentences without the need for any of them being physically spoken. To listen to the unspoken words, the researchers used a method called electroencephalopagram, an EEG. I got that right on the first try. Technology records electrical activity from the brain using an array of electrodes on the scalp to detect brain waves. Kind of a sneak preview for the interview we're going to do with Joe Gisondi today, because I mentioned this on the show, but it is amazing. I won't mention what I said on the show. You can listen for that. But it is amazing that in our lifetime, most likely in our lifetime, in fact, if this is correct, it is in our lifetime, all of the years that humans have been on this earth and all of the stories in fables and such of the ability to read minds and prophecy and such, mind reading, I guess mind reading and prophecy are two different things, but it's amazing to think that in our lifetime, if you think of how long a human life is and how long humans have been on this earth, in our lifetime, the ability to read minds will likely be discovered. It's kind of amazing. Got allergies? Blame Neanderthals. Humans can thank their Neanderthal ancestors for giving them the genes that fight diseases, but also for their allergies, new research suggests. Genetic variants found in modern humans that originally came from Neanderthals may predispose the human immune system to overreact to environmental allergens, according to new studies published January 7th in the American Journal of Human Genetics. Did Neanderthals go extinct because they were hunted and eaten by our early human ancestors? It's a grisly but possible explanation for their demise. Trace shows us the evidence. But these Neanderthal loner genes may have had a silver lining. I believe that Neanderthal going extinct because they may have been eaten may have been from a totally different story, but that's beside the point here. Studies also found that interbreeding with Neanderthals may have helped ancient humans who came from Africa get a head start in settling Europe. So if you're out there and you have got terrible allergies, well, you can thank Neanderthals. But you should also be thanking them for your genes that fight diseases. By interbreeding with these archaic humans, we modern humans gained various advantageous adaptations. We are well adapted to the local climate, foods, and pathogens. So you can thank the Neanderthals for that. This one's interesting because we're going to be talking about Monster Trek later on today with Joe Gisondi. He goes out there and he interviews various guys. He goes on a number of expeditions with the guys that hunt for Bigfoot. He essentially wanted to know what makes these guys tick. What makes a person want to search for Bigfoot? Are these people crazy? This story here is interesting. A prehistoric species of giant ape went extinct because it could not adapt to its changing environment. Much bigger than a man, the enormous primate Gigantopithecus was twice as large as any of today's great apes and stood up to 10 feet tall while weighing it at more than 1,100 pounds. Does this sound familiar? Of course, there are a lot of Bigfoot researchers who believe that Bigfoot may be a Gigantopithecus or a relative of Gigantopithecus. What happened to the Gigantopithecus? Well, it says here, species lived across parts of what is now Southern Asia and roamed the planet from around 9 million years ago until its disappearance somewhere around 100,000 years ago. Exactly what caused the demise of these huge forest-dwelling apes has long remained a topic of debate among scientists, and to date only a few teeth and a few jaw fossils have ever been found. Now, however, scientists in Germany have put forward a new theory suggesting that the reason the species died out was because it failed to adapt its diet to the changing Pleistocene landscape. Dr. Hervey Bockerins said, due to its size, Gigantopithecus presumably depended on a large amount of food. When during the Pleistocene era more and more forested areas turned into savanna landscapes, there was simply an insufficient food supply for the giant ape. Now, this is interesting because A, it suggests that there was not enough food to support this giant ape. Now, granted, the change here, it says, was from a forested area to a more savanna-type area. That's why they didn't have enough food. So one could argue that, yes, the Gigantopithecus originally allegedly died out because there was not enough food to support it. However, if we presume that there is such a thing as Bigfoot, it does live now in a forested area, does not live in a savanna landscape. And so maybe in the deep forests of this country, there is enough food to support a Bigfoot-type creature. Which is a good segue to our interview today. We're going to be joined by Joe Gisondi. He is the author of Monster Trek. We're going to be talking about the research he has done on researchers. If you've ever wondered what it's like to hang out with a Matt Moneymaker, with a Jeff Meldrum, you're going to find out today. We're going to talk about his investigations into what makes a Bigfoot researcher tick. Joe Gisondi is our guest, and we'll be back with him in just a moment here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Joe Gisondi, author of a number of different books, including Monster Trek, The Obsessive Search for Bigfoot, as well as, on a completely unrelated note, at least in terms of this show, Covering Sports, a field guide to covering sports. We'll be talking about all of this here on the show today. Joe, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing today, Brian?
Not too bad. This is a show about things like Bigfoot, but my other job is I cover pro wrestling. And so when I saw that
really?
That's right, pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. So I saw that you had the field guide to covering sports, and I thought, wow, well, that's interesting. Two topics I know a little bit about. So maybe
yeah, I used to be how many years ago, you know, back in the 80s, I used to watch the wrestling all the time. As a matter of fact, I sat at one of the Super Bowls in Tampa when I was in college. We were outside the stadium and grilling and everything. We sat next to Barry Windham.
Wow.
Out there, which was really cool.
I cannot tell you how many guys I've interviewed on this show, and either before or after the show, they've mentioned, you know, I was such a big wrestling fan back in the 80s, and not so much today, but it was
right.
Certainly very popular back then. We could talk more about that later, but I think everybody wants to hear about
sure.
Bigfoot and such. Monster Trek is your book, The Obsessive Search for Bigfoot. If you go to joegisondi.com, there is information on how to order. It is available right now only in paperback. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. That is correct.
Let's talk about this. The book itself is, I mean, you've been out there, but really it's also talking a lot about the other people who are out there, the Matt Moneymakers of the world, who are out there looking for Bigfoot. How did you get involved and decide this would be a great topic for a book?
Well, I've always been interested in it. I mentioned a little bit in the beginning of how I got interested in it, which is my mom used to get the National Enquirer back when it was more about ghosts and Bigfoot and UFOs than it was about TMZ stuff that you got today. So I was always fascinated by that. So, but I never did much on it except that whenever I'd see something, I'd read it. You know, sometimes I'd come across something in college on microfiche or something and always thought it would be pretty cool to go out on an expedition. So I was working on my on an MFA, Master's of Fine Arts in Writing, and I was thinking about something I like. Well, I hike and camp all the time. I love spending time in the outdoors. I love the interest of Bigfoot. I love mysteries. And one thing about journalism, which is what I teach here at Eastern, is that, you know, I tell my students, if you're looking for a good story, write about somebody who's passionate about something. So in this book, I was curious why people were so passionate about looking for Bigfoot, why they would, you know, sometimes put their careers aside or spend tens of thousands of dollars to go on out there and find more about it. And I wanted to know more about that. So I went out with about seven different groups at different places across the country or individuals and spent time with them. So it's written in first person. it's about my experiences with them, but it's also about the research on them and the areas, and talking about, like, in Southern Illinois, who knew there's a big paranormal history there. But ultimately, I found out in almost every area there's a paranormal connection there, too, in the places we went, whether it was in the Ouachita Mountains in Oklahoma or in the Wind River Mountains. I went out with John Mazinski and Dr. Jeff Milton out there, or even Ohio. I stuck mostly with the Midwest and this part of the country because the far west has been overly explored. So I wanted to show that people are searching all over the country outside of the Pacific Northwest.
I forget exactly how you termed it in that first chapter, but it was something like, I don't normally believe in this sort of thing, but if somebody tells me they've seen something, I can be quick to believe it. Was that sort of how it was?
For me?
Yes.
Yes and no. You know, part of the book was me trying to figure out, do I believe? But that was really secondary to, I really wanted to know why these other people believed and why they did it. But as a journalist, you know, one of the best things you can do to get information, and one of the worst at the same time, is eyewitness testimony. Police officers will tell you the same thing, and we see that all the time in court cases. As a matter of fact, if anybody's checking out How to Make a Murderer, you know, that Netflix show, you know, you'll see that as well. But I've had so many people tell me that they've seen Bigfoot, and I have no reason to believe they're lying, which tells me either they did see Bigfoot, or they believe they saw something that appeared to be like Bigfoot. So,
sure.
Yeah, that compelled me a lot.
You obviously, as noted, had gone camping a lot, and you talk about how, I think it was like the first time you were ever given a FLIR, and you looked through it, you thought, oh my God, do I see something here? Did you, when you were camping as a youngster, I mean, did you ever have any sort of experiences that you thought might have been Bigfoot, or was it not until you were out there with people in places where Bigfoot allegedly was that you thought that maybe you might have seen something?
It was afterwards that I had suspicions. I don't know if I did or not. I never saw Bigfoot, but although in that FLIR with Matt out in the middle of the woods that one night, I wonder, you know, you think the first time you look out at something, you go, God, is that really something kneeling down looking at me, or was it not? But no, I mean, one time when I was up in the in North Georgia, I've done whitewater rafting and things like that up in our, you know, I think it was the Black Mountains, I think, in that area near Clayton, Georgia. One night I was absolutely terrified to walk down the trail to go to the bathroom. It was late at night. Everybody was sleeping. It was probably like 1, 2 in the morning. I got out of the tent, and I was just terrified. I thought, what the hell? I was never really scared ever before, and I just did not want to walk out there that night. But I didn't think anything about that till later on when people were telling me that perhaps there's some sort of element of that where, I don't know if it's pheromones or whatever it is. I don't know, and of course no one does know exactly. But people have been terrified, you know, just looking at a creature. And one other time is out, I lived in DeLand, which is about a half hour west of Daytona Beach. And we used to go out camping in a couple of different places and hiking. And one day I was on this island all by myself, onto an island, and I'd hear bang, bang. And at first I thought it was woodpeckers or something like that. But in retrospect, maybe it was something else, maybe it wasn't.
Let's talk a little bit about Matt Moneymaker, because you talk about him in the first chapter. And he obviously, the face of Finding Bigfoot, the new season just started last week. It's season 8 or something like that. And as you note, at the time of the writing you wrote, they had not found Bigfoot yet. And I can confirm that as of the time we're recording this, they still haven't found Bigfoot. But they keep looking. In the early episodes of like season 1, Matt Moneymaker, to me, came off as a very unlikable character. And now, by season 8 or so, I don't know what it is, but he's very different now. He seems like he's a much more likable character. I don't know if they wanted them to do certain things early on in the season and then found that it didn't play well with audiences, or I don't know what his real personality is. Tell us a little bit about your dealings with Matt Moneymaker.
Well, I was just recently talking to some people who know him and said that very same thing, is that he seems to have changed a great deal, softened up perhaps. Because he and I had a conversation when we were in the Wichita Mountains, when that was the first group I ever went out with the DFRO. And he was asking me about Tom Biscardi, who was the first person who had talked to me. And I guess later on we can talk a little about that if you want to. I was supposed to go out with him at the same time that ultimately that whole fiasco down in North Georgia happened. Well, he was asking me some questions, and Matt and I had a really good conversation. And he was talking about trying to get a show I think at the time it was Nat Geo, and it wasn't the Animal Planet. And, of course, the show actually came out. I don't know him well enough to say why he would have changed, if, in fact, he did. I know with my interactions with him, he was rather generous with his time and kind with me. As a matter of fact, I got lost a little bit on some of the back roads trying to get out there, and he's the one who met me in the middle of the night and caught up with me, and we drove, and he helped me drive back into the woods, and that's why he and I were all alone at that one area looking through FLIRs and what have you. And he was very kind and generous with his time with me. When I saw him, I guess it was several months later, at least in North Carolina, we talked not nearly as much because I think a lot more people were around him and he didn't have time. But he seemed nice enough. And the only time I had any problems is that he found out later that I never signed a non-disclosure agreement for these PFRO things. And as a journalist, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to let somebody else have control over my content. And somebody got upset and banned me from any more BFRO, which I was about ready to go off and to go to non-BFRO people anyway. But at the very end, as the book was coming out, they were willing to let me use some of their material as well. So I personally have never had any real problems with him, and he's been nothing but, amenable with me. But I know that he is certainly at, I don't know what the right word would be.
He's a controversial character.
Yes, to say the least. There's a lot of people. And hearing the stories and reading the things, I definitely get it, and I understand that. But first, with a one-on-one, I had no problems whatsoever.
I have, in your book, you write about how you once got lost, and Matt Moneymaker came to save the day. And you're following him, and he says to you, make sure you turn off your headlights, because Bigfoots don't like the lights, or something of that nature. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So, you're a journalist, and I am not a classically trained journalist, but over a lifetime, I've become a journalist, because this is my job.
Oh, sure.
As a journalist, when I hear somebody say, turn your lights off because Bigfoots don't like the headlights, my first thought is, hold on a second. How do you know this? And that's the one thing about the show. I enjoy the show. I like the show. But there's always that deal where Matt in particular and Cliff is another one. Really, I really like Cliff. Seems like a really nice, likable guy. But they're always telling us what Bigfoots do and do not like, how they behave. And as a journalist, I look at it and I go, how do you know any of this? Like, what are we basing any of this on? How did you, I mean, I'm sure you encountered a ton of that. I mean, I guess my question is, what do you make of some of these statements that you heard from some of these Bigfooters?
Well, I find whether I'm covering Bigfoot or if I was covering sports or anything like that, when people make statements, if you start challenging them, they stop talking to you. So when people make statements, I really try to keep as open mind as possible and go, okay, maybe that's the case. I don't know. I don't know that anybody knows really much about Bigfoot whatsoever, if it exists, because we haven't done any sort of studies and what have you. So when he said, turn the lights off, I wasn't thinking so much is this a crazy notion or is this an accurate notion? I was thinking, I'm going to be driving through the backwoods near cliffs in the middle of the night, driving with my lights off,
yes,
hoping that I don't go flying off the side there. But I know what you're talking about there, which is, you know, people make all kinds of outlandish claims, whether it's Donald Trump about politics or Matt about Bigfoot or something like that. And I don't know. I try not to judge. It certainly, as a journalist, I really make a big effort of being as neutral as possible about things like that. I do address it a couple of times here and there in the book, but I don't know. I guess, yeah, there's two ways certainly of looking at Bigfoot, period, as far as this. One is when people say that, they sound, you know, bat crazy.
Yes.
And the other one is, you know, this person has some insight. I think there's also some, there's a whole lot in between there. Someone like Matt, who's been out in the woods, or Cliff, who's sort of become a friend of mine from conversations there, when they when they're out there, they're seeing some things we haven't seen. So certainly he has more knowledge of a possible creature than I do. But I don't, I guess what it comes down to, maybe this is what you're asking, is when people tell me that, do I believe it? No, I don't believe anything until it's proven to me.
Well, I guess,
I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, I was just going to say, I guess what I'm really trying to say here is I don't expect you to go out there and debate him as he's telling you to turn the lights off, but I just kind of feel like it's hard for me to take seriously somebody who wouldn't, for example, preface it by saying, you know, I don't think they like the lights. I don't think. Well, as in, it's an opinion. But when they start telling you these facts about Bigfoot, it's sort of like, okay, now I think that you're building this narrative based on literally nothing. And it's hard for me to take seriously anything you say from this point forward because you're telling me all of these facts that are not, in fact, facts.
Right. Right. It's, they aren't. I mean, a whole lot of Bigfooting right now is based upon, there's not a whole lot of facts out there. There's not some, and again, not to dismiss it, there's, you know, Jeff Meldrum and with the prints and, you know, you mentioned Cliff Berkman and some things that he said and some others said. There's some things I guess you could possibly believe to be true, and I have no reason not to believe the things that you're telling me. On the other hand, I'm not going to absolutely believe them. I guess what's happening is we're having this narrative built about what Bigfoot is and what Bigfoot isn't without the science to disprove it. I think that's sort of what you're focusing on a little bit here. And I agree with you, is that the narrative. For me, in the book, my narrative was to let these people say these things and record what people said and let other people believe whether it's, you know, that crazy or has some credibility there whatsoever. But, yeah, you're having a whole lot of that. I talked to a guy in Kentucky in one of the expeditions who starts telling me things about that and then, like, rods that you've probably heard of, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Going through these dimensions and UFOs chasing them through the back hills of Nevada, and I'm just, you know, he was probably the only person I came across, and I started thinking, I need to get away from this person.
You know, that's where I wanted to go here, because I have been on a BFRO investigation, and I'm not going to paint everybody with a wide brush. I'm going to tell you the way that it was. There were a lot of people on this investigation that I had a lot of respect for in the sense that they flat out said, you know, we don't know anything. We have no idea what's going on. All of this is experimental. You know, we're going to try some knocks because that's what people do. But who knows? Who knows what they could be? You know, they're most of what you hear and see, it's going to be some sort of animal. I mean, they were very scientific about it. As scientific as you can be in looking for Bigfoot. They were just out there. They didn't even know if it existed, but they were just trying to do some experiments and maybe see if they could come up with anything. This was the majority. And there were a few people that had similar crazy stories. There was one guy who was just everywhere he went, there were Bigfoot everywhere. And he was telling me these stories of this infrared power that they had and they could cause and cure cancer. I'm just thinking, what is happening here? But he was in the minority. So I guess my question to you is, in your travels, you don't have to mention any names, but what percentage of these people, because your average person would think 100% of them are crazy, but that's not true.
Oh, that's absolutely what most people think, right?
But it's not true. It's actually a small percentage, I think. What did you find?
I completely agree with that. I'm constantly telling people, I've talked to engineers and bankers and teachers and, you know, all kinds of people who are really sane people who, you know, I find that there's probably about three different groups of people that go out on who are searching for Bigfoot or on these expeditions. One are the ones who are just truly interested in possibly learning more, open-minded, like the people you're talking about. You also have people who believe they saw something at some point, and they want to find out what it is they saw and maybe recapture that. And then you also have people who I think are just lonely and just finding some way to be part of a group or something like that. As far as the crazy or the nuts or things like that, I think that's a very low percentage, a really low percentage. Of course, something like this is going to attract it. Anything about Bigfoot or UFOs or paranormal, whether or not any of these things are true or not, I think you're going to get a lot of people who come out that way. I agree with you completely. But again, small percentage.
Yes, small percentage. Tell us some of the interesting stories, kind of a preview of some of the different areas that you went in the book. You mentioned that everywhere you go, and this is true. I mean, I haven't been everywhere, obviously, but having done this show for a long time, I mean, there are few areas of this country that don't have their share of local legends, whether it be Bigfoot or UFOs or whatever it might be. Tell us a little bit about some of your travels, where you've been, and some of the stories you've heard.
Okay. Let's see. One was one of my favorite ones, maybe because I lived down there for 24 years in Florida, was at the Green Swamp in Florida. And I don't know if you've been down in that area at all, or if you're familiar with Florida. But it's about an hour and a half north of Tampa. It sort of comes out of the Ocala National Forest, but not exactly. There's still some disconnect there. It's a big, huge area. My wife was a biologist for the state of Florida for 10 years before we moved up to Illinois. And she was out on airboats and doing alligator egg checks and this, going up to her hips in swamps and all kinds of stuff. Well, and we hiked all over this. In fact, last week I was in Florida. I did some hiking in near St. Augustine and some camping and some canoeing down in Florida. Well, this stuff was really thick. I mean, this is stuff that it's like machete thick where you're trying to cut through all of that stuff. So we're out in the middle of this for a couple of days, and, I mean, just can't move anyone. Of course, when I'm in Florida, my main concern is stepping on a pygmy rattler or, you know, bothering a gator or something along those lines.
Sure.
Well, we went through there for a couple of days. Well, on the last day I was there, we were hanging out by a river, and people weren't sure if they saw anything. So we came back to camp. And I don't know if you ever knew Carol Ann Solomon. She went out on her own in this area a lot, which, whether Bigfoot exists or not, that can be a scary thing because there are some cats out there and all kinds of wildlife that could happen. Well, she does a call. We're on the edge of all this thickness that goes back tens and tens, if not in some areas, hundreds of miles. And I'm sitting next to her with my recorder in my hand, like a moron. I never ended up turning it on. But we start hearing something that could possibly have been an owl. And then after a while, it's from like about two or three different directions, and I don't know if it was an echo or if it was something else, and it starts getting louder. And it starts, as it's getting closer and closer, it's almost like listening to like the Planet of the Apes when they're all getting crazy and they're running and screaming and things like that. It's getting closer and closer and closer. And then it just stops right in front of us. We're like sitting 6-8 feet from the wood line. Well, for something to travel that fast through that tangle, I know the woods in Florida. I know that type of swamp. That was amazing. So unless it were flying, that's not going to happen. And it better be flying high because the tangles of brushes. So that was the most bizarre thing that I ever saw. Carol Ann said, yeah, there's our 800-pound owl, something like that. One of the most intriguing stories for me is a guy named Don Young, who was a guide up in northern Wisconsin. Don grew up in the woods. He was part Native American, would just sleep in the woods at night, and then suddenly he saw something. And twice. And around his house, he lives in the middle of nowhere. I went up to his house up in the, you know, in the swampy area of, you know, you go up all the state highways in Wisconsin, and then they end, and then you drive some more for a couple hours, and then you get to Don's house. And this guy wrote a book on hunting for white-tailed deer and all kinds of things. He was afraid to go back out into the woods. He felt like he was chased down at one point, and everybody heard about it, and he ended up losing his livelihood of being a guide. And he and I spent some time for a day walking through all the areas and him talking to me about it. And we talked countless times on the phone as well. But, you know, here's a guy who lived in the woods. Here's a guy who knew the difference between any tracks at all. And he saw something he had never seen before, and it scared the hell out of him. He eventually started going back into the woods, and he's doing some research, mostly to get his life back. So that story, I thought, was one of the most intriguing one there, too.
Let's talk about that one for a second, because it is really interesting. If you are a hardcore skeptic and you think there's nothing out there, there's no Bigfoot, doesn't exist, here's a guy who, as you noted, he's lived there, he's been out there his whole life. He lost his livelihood as a result of this. And it really does get you thinking, if it doesn't exist, what did this guy see that he just couldn't identify, and it spiraled into what it spiraled into? What could that have possibly been? I mean, it's almost easier to think maybe it was a Sasquatch than, you know, whatever natural known creature it could have been that caused all of this craziness.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I think. You know, he could certainly be a really good liar, but why would you, I mean, by telling these stories, no one would go out in the woods with him because they thought, who wants to go out with this crazy guy? Why would you lie like that and lose your livelihood?
Yeah, it's not like he got an Animal Planet show out of it. He got nothing out of it. He lost everything.
Absolutely. And he shares some photos and things like that online with me as well, and some interesting things, but nothing, of course, ever compelling. I mean, visually. But yeah, that story, or even another guy, John Mazinski. John is the consummate scientist with journals and everything like that in the Wind River Rat Mountains out in Wyoming. He does research with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. And I went out with those guys for a couple of days, and here's a guy who has done, he was on the original grizzly bear counts back in the 70s, and he's the bighorn sheep expert in the country, and just knows everything. I mean, reminds me of like a modern William Bartram or something like that. You know, writing little notes and books and things like that. And well, he had a situation where he believes he encountered a Bigfoot. And this is a guy who knows, like Don Young, everything about it. In fact, he lives in a cabin he built on his own, and he's off the grid as far as living, and just he's just amazing. He's worked for the state of Wyoming. He's worked for the national, federal agency, but probably the national, the one that whoever does the grizzly bears and the state parks and everything like that. This is a real brilliant guy as far as mind, and he's not one who takes things, you know, casually. And he was out there. This is a guy who, to check whether or not grizzly bear were aggressive in Yellowstone or if they would attack people, went out in a mummy sleeping bag and just laid out in the woods to see if a grizzly bear would eat him.
Sounds like a bad plan.
And they came up to him. He told some amazing stories about that I wrote about. And, I mean, this guy believes there's something out there. And who am I to say that these two outdoorsmen and scientists didn't see something? Whether it's not for Bigfoot, there might be something out there.
This brings us to an interesting topic here, and that is that you have talked to people who seem extremely sincere and very firmly believe that there is something out there. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, you could argue footprints, you could argue some hair samples, but the reality is, as far as evidence that the scientific community would accept, there is none. Zero. None. Absolutely none. So that obviously brings up the question, what is everybody seeing as we talked about here? And I went to the Sasquatch Summit a couple of weeks ago. They do it annually in Ocean Shores, Washington. And all sorts of Bigfoot folks are there. And this guy named Tom Powell was going to give a presentation. And I had been warned, this guy is something else. And they didn't outright say this guy is crazy. But they said, like, this is a guy that's going to make the other Bigfoot people very uncomfortable. And he gives his presentation, and essentially it's about maybe Bigfoot is a paranormal entity. Maybe Bigfoot comes from another dimension. And when I say that, people are going to listen and go, okay, this guy is totally out of his mind. But you know what? Whether you believe the guy or not, he at least was looking at this in the sense that, listen, we have no evidence that this thing is an animal. All of you here at this conference think this thing is an animal, and you firmly believe that. We have absolutely no evidence. So maybe what we have to do is look at another theory. Maybe it is an interdimensional being. Maybe it is a paranormal entity. And the idea does sound crazy, but you know what? The guy is looking at other options. And I don't know what's going on, but what do you think about the idea? I mean, clearly these people believe they've seen something that we have zero evidence exists. Do you feel that there are people out there that believe that this is a paranormal entity? Have you ever thought about anything like that? What are your thoughts on just the very idea of this?
Well, and let me preface this by, I am and by no means an expert on any of this, none. The only thing that I gain some experience and insights in is to why people search for Bigfoot. But you're asking about the people that have come across, and I've come across a few of them, but it seems to me that the people that I've talked to, whether on the expeditions or elsewhere, that the people who believe in the paranormal or that UFOs drop them off here, they are from another planet or something like that, are the minority. And like you said, they do make everybody else feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
Most of the people that are serious about it are believing that it's some sort of natural animal that has not been found. And maybe has some intelligence or beyond what an ape would, more like a human. But yeah, all these other areas I know, like Eric Beckyard, you know, I remember he and I talked early on, and I remember him screaming at me one day before he passed away. And from people who know him, and I talked to him twice on the phone, I hear he's brilliant. His IQ is like really high or off the charts. And I know doing reading on him that he believed in the whole paranormal and interdimensional, and that's why we can't find them and all these other different things. As to whether or not that exists, my mind's open to everything. It really absolutely is. But until there's some hard evidence, I'm not going to believe that it exists. So, I don't tend to believe that I'm not inclined to believe more in that area, but if something comes out, well, maybe.
I feel the same way. I respect those guys that will go out and say something that will make the general Bigfoot community uncomfortable, because they are believing in an animal that it seems to be an impossibility based on the size, how much food it would need, the fact it's never been found, there's never been a body. It seems impossible. And so if it seems impossible, I mean, maybe you need to open your mind to a scenario that also seems impossible. That seems rational to me.
Yeah, it's sort of a, I guess, what is that, like a double negative? So
sure.
It could be a positive, I don't know. Yeah, again, any of these things possibly could, because like you say, it seems impossible that an animal that is as large as a Bigfoot would be could remain away from science for this long. Yet, you talk to people like a John Mazinski or a Don Young or anybody who's been out there, and you think, well, maybe. Maybe.
Now, you mentioned that you... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, that was it.
I was going to say, you mentioned that you'd moved away from the BFRO and you were working, or you'd gone out with some unaffiliated groups. Are you still out there looking here and there, or what's the status?
I am not, but if someone were to invite me, I would love to go back out there. As a matter of fact, the only lament I have is I got an eye injury right before it happened. I got hit in the eye with a racquetball, and not to get into it, but I had a couple of surgeries. So I was originally planning on going out on an expedition with someone in Washington, whether it would be Cliff or somebody else, and I'm sorry that I was not able to. I'm hoping that I will be able to go out again. Cliff had mentioned something the other day about possibly some out there or something like that, and I've had people all over the country, you know, say, come on out there and come to this and come to that. And if I have the time, I absolutely would love to. This is something that will continue to intrigue me until the day I die, even if they find something or they don't, because I'd really love to know the answer to this. But like Don Keating, who you probably know, you know, running the Bigfoot conferences in Ohio and everything, he's feeling kind of pretty negative at this point. Going, he goes, "I'm not going to find anything before I die."
Wow.
He talks about that here in the book, that about his feelings today about everything and how sad he is about some things. And but yeah, man, how can you not be intrigued by this stuff? I dig all this stuff. You know, whether or not I believe, again, give me the evidence. But you know, I want to believe, and I want to know more about, you know, UFOs and ghosts and, you know, any of these other things. I think it's pretty cool to listen about it. It keeps your mind open about everyday things as well.
I want to get into UFOs and ghosts here in a second, but how well do you know Cliff?
I don't know him. I wouldn't say really, really well. He and I have had several conversations through the years, and I saw him in St. Augustine at a conference. We, you know, had dinner and everything like that. So I would never claim to be a bestie or anything like that, but I consider him a friend at this point, and I like him a great deal, and I respect the things he's doing and trying to do. So I don't want to, you know how you meet people several times, and after a while you sort of develop a friendship and
sure,
you know, something like that. So
well, let me ask you about him then, because everything that I have seen or read about Cliff that is not associated with finding Bigfoot, he seems like a very rational, level-headed researcher. But
oh,
then,
absolutely.
When you watch him on the show, everything is a Bigfoot. It's weird. His television persona seems exactly the opposite of everything that I've ever seen that he's written or said online about anything. It's bizarre to me.
Well, I think part of that is, and again, this is no insight, this is just from talking to people in reality TV and hearing some things perhaps about that show. It's a TV show.
Sure.
And I think that probably anybody on that show or any other reality show will realize this has nothing to do with reality.
Well,
we need to do certain things to keep ratings up, you know, something along those lines. That would be my guess, perhaps, or based on some conversations I've had with people in those types of shows. So this reality show is, it's not really based so much in reality. It's about, it's the thing I like. I like finding Bigfoot. And the reason I like it is that they go to a new place and I get to learn about a new part of the country.
Yeah.
I get to learn what stories are in that area. And then they go through the woods and, you know, maybe they find stuff and they talk and they're interesting, fun people to follow. And, so for that reason, I'm a fan of the show. I think he's more of a voice of reason in many, many situations than the one over the top, I think. But again, what do I know?
Now, you mentioned being interested in UFOs, ghosts, all of it, as you noted. Mm-hmm. And UFOs, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Ghosts and Bigfoot actually have something in common that UFOs do not. And that is that Bigfoot allegedly reside in an area that you can investigate. Ghosts usually reside in an area that you can investigate. UFOs are just, hey, this dude saw a UFO somewhere. It's not like they congregate, for example. I mean, sometimes they're alleged flap areas. But it's harder to do a UFO investigation because where do you go? I mean, I guess you could go try and find, you know, Area 51 or something like that. But in general, it's UFOs are much more random. Ghost encounters, it's like, okay, well, let's do an investigation. Let's go to this house. Bigfoot, you can go to a certain area. Have you ever done a ghost investigation? Is that something that you have considered for the future?
Oh, I'd love to do a book on all of these things, to tell you the truth, you know, given the time to do that. I've got some other writing projects working on, but I'd always be interested in that. As far as, you know, I just drove back from Florida and I'm listening to all kinds of different things on the radio or podcasts or what have you about these things. Yeah, ghosts are, I mean, when I was younger, I mean, I can get scared pretty easily, you know, by stuff.
Oh, yeah.
People start talking about demonology and stuff like that, and, you know, that gives me the heebie-jeebies. I don't know as a kid if I ever saw the entire Exorcist. So, I realize not all ghosts are supposed to be like that, but, I love ghost stories. They're just so much fun to read and to investigate. You know, that would be kind of fun. When the Ghost Hunters show came out, I remember my youngest daughter and I, every night when it came on, would just sit down and watch a show or two every night. So, you know, although ghosts and Bigfoot, you know, ghosts might be, like you said, interdimensional, you know, who knows what's going on with that. Or maybe it's all our imagination because, man, we sure are a creative people. You know, humans sure are creative. And, you know, when you look at a bunch of sticks or a cloud and you can see, you know, a dragon or whatever it happens to be, our imaginations are always running wild. So maybe we've created almost all of these, but it's still fun to think about.
I did go to Hawaii last year, and there's a lot of old retired people in Hawaii. And I went to a library, and every book was from the 70s, which is kind of funny. And in the 70s, you know, the 60s and 70s, it was a time, I mean, the paranormal was big in the 60s and 70s. I was very, very young. I was born in 1975, so by the time I could read, I was going to the library and reading books that had been out for a little while, but I grew up on all of this stuff from that time period, and it seems to me that it kind of fell off a little bit in the 80s and a little bit in the 90s, but it's back big time today, so...
Oh, yeah.
I guess if you're a fan of this, this is a great time to be alive.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as far as UFOs, I can't, with all these probes going into outer space, and they've been able to do a 3D map of the galaxy as far as they can tell, and you look at this, you think, how in the world could we be the only sentient life anywhere in the galaxy? That's just absurd to think about. As to whether or not anything's visited here, well, that's the other question. I mean, whether or not they have. Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But, you know, that's just intriguing to think about. I'm blown away every time I go to Chicago and I go to the planetarium. I just look up in the sky and go, man, I really am like a speck in this whole existence of whatever it is in the universe. But it's still cool to look at it and imagine, you know, what it would be like, you know, to come across some other, some sort of beings that may or may not be somewhat like us. And I think that's part of why people try to research Bigfoot is they can't go out to Alpha Centauri or, you know, some other place hundreds of light years away, but they can go in the local woods with some other people and see if they can unravel that mystery.
It is pretty amazing when you think about how short a human life is, that if you consider the amount of time that humans have been on this Earth, you and I may be living right now in the time period where we discover that we're not alone in the universe. It's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's pretty cool, too.
Oh, yeah. Let's plug the book here. I want to give you a chance to get some information out about Monster Trek, The Obsessive Search for Bigfoot. You've got some other books as well, and any social media. Let's get some plugs out here.
The book, as you've been talking about, there's... It's really based around going to 8 different places in the country. I went to Oklahoma, North Carolina, Southern Illinois, Florida, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Ohio, and Wyoming. And it's part of, as I went out there in these travels, I described some of the things we saw, the conversations we had, described the people who were there, talk about the local stories. Not a whole lot about it doesn't go into like some of the books where it really goes into, here's all the Bigfoot situations in the area. But it talks a little bit about it as it's needed, some of the paranormal, whatever. But it's really focusing on these people. It's like, why do they do what they do? And what are the things they saw? you know, it's been a lot of fun researching this. I wish I could make the book twice as long and go back out like we were talking about earlier.
The West Coast. West Coast is underrepresented in this book here.
Well, it's I don't go farther than Wyoming. I did not go out west because everybody, when they think of Bigfoot, at least the people I come across, oh yeah, it's up in Northern California or Oregon or Washington.
Sure.
So I show here's all the people who are researching all over here, and most of the people wanted to allow me to go out there and were pretty candid. As far as social media, I teach sports journalism. I help run a national college sports journalism workshop, and I used to be a sports writer for years down in Florida. So I have a Twitter feed that's just at Joe Gisondi that really focuses on sports journalism and things like that for training, and it goes with the field guide that I'm working on, a second edition. That's used mostly by people who want to go into sports media and classes across the country and in classrooms. And I also have, if you want, I have at Monster Trek JG. That's my Twitter feed for things about Bigfoot. That if I hear something or talk, I retweet and I write. And if I go out on another expedition, I'd probably tweet the whole thing out. So if anybody wants to invite me, I'd be glad to go out there and do that.
That's right. And the book Monster Trek: The Obsessive Search for Bigfoot. Joe Gisondi is the author. You can find it online at Joe Gisondi on Twitter, at Monster Trek JG on Twitter as well. So check all of that out. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And hopefully, if you ever head out again, we can do this again.
Oh, that'd be wonderful, Brian.
And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network, every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Dark Matter Digital Network, also online, afterdarkradioshow.com, which is the website. Make sure you head up there and check that out. There's all sorts of great stuff up on the After Dark Radio Show website. The new Carl Stern Show exclusively at afterdarkradioshow.com, although it is moving to the Dark Matter Digital Network very soon. We'll keep you updated on that on the website. And also the new columns by Mark Howes. Wanted to jump into the email here really quickly. The email bin. If you'd like to send me an email for the show, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com is the email. And this here is from Troy. If you recall, over the last couple of weeks, we've been sending out requests for those that have memories before the age of one. And Troy here says, I've got a rather strange memory to share. And the way in which I remember it leads me to believe that it must have been from a very, very early time in my life, if not prior to my birth. I'm pretty skeptical of that notion, but here is specifically what I remember. I remember being in my early childhood house, where I only lived until I was about 4. I remember walking down a particular hallway in that house, and my point of view was from a few feet off of the ground. I remember walking down that hallway for a few seconds, and then the memory goes dark. The strange part of it is that I don't remember the actual experience of walking down the hallway. All I remember is the experience of moving down the hallway without actually moving my body at all. I only remember the experience of walking. But it was as if I wasn't actually walking, if that makes sense. I don't live in that house long enough for it to make sense from my perspective. I would not have been tall enough to see that experience from the perspective that I did had I been walking. It was from too high off the ground. This leads me to think that I was either being carried or that I was seeing this happening from inside the womb. The height at which I remember it leads me to believe the latter. So this, he believes, is a memory, something that he saw from inside the womb. Science, he says, has always fascinated me. But this whole experience is quite out there, so I'm very doubtful of my own theory here. Is it possible? It is a very vivid memory. I remember it very clearly. And for whatever reason, pre-birth memory is a conclusion I have drawn based on how I see it in my head. Of course, it's very interesting to me because I've got a baby on the way. We are less than 8 weeks away from the birth of our daughter, Paisley. And she is very, very active. And I wonder what's going on in there. They say that she can hear our voices. We talk to her all the time. I've heard that sometimes when babies cry, when dad comes and talks to them, they stop crying because they remember that voice. They associate, maybe remember is not the right word, but they know of that voice from inside the womb, and it is soothing to them. So it's going to be a very interesting time, as I'm sure all of you parents out there are well aware. That is it for today, everybody. I want to thank you so much for listening to the show. Once again, I recommend you head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. All sorts of great stuff up there. We've got the new RSS feed for The Anomalist. You can check out all the great stuff up there on that website. All sorts of cool stuff as well from our end. We have got this show with Joe Gisondi, which is going to be up as a free download. I'll upload it. It's free upload, free download. Check it out there at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, as well as Dragon King Dark Episode 1 with Carl Stern, where he's talking about fear. Also, the new columns by Mark Howes. Got a lot of great stuff up there. And, of course, the Facebook page, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. And again, if you love the show, I recommend that you spread the word. You can spread the word on Twitter, Facebook, any social media. You're welcome to spread the word on different websites. Trying to get the word out about After Dark Radio Show. And I do appreciate all of the support. We got a lot of listeners here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, and I very much appreciate that. That is it from here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you again next time. Thanks, Keith Rowland, everybody at Dark Matter. And we'll talk to you again next week, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.